Today's date is the 31st day of October 2009. My name is, of course, Daryl Bradford Smith. Been a little while since we had a show to do here with you folks, and I can't be happier to bring on my guest, my returning guest. He's been working with me on research for over 3 years now, going on four almost. And boy, time flies when you're following criminals all over the globe and through history. His name is James Dickey or Yaakov Zaki, if you are a Muslim from his Islamic ties. We are going to talk about the diaspora, but more importantly, why is it that this group of people is repeatedly the Zionist criminals that we discuss every day? And they weren't always called Zionists, but the same powerful forces that form Zionism are in control and have been for very, very long time. Why is it this group is asked to leave almost every place it settles in? And why is it that they ultimately leave under charges of manipulation and currency control and fraud and usury and some of the charges are horrific. Blood libel, many things that they are charged with when they're asked to frog marched out of the countries they've invaded are often heinous crimes, even that you can't even imagine someone committing if they were a part of the human family. So we're going to bring them on right now. James, are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you 100%.
Well, you know, James, that's kind of an open-ended introduction to the machinations of this group being asked to leave many, many countries, and you've looked into it repeatedly, and I have as well. But we know today the Sephardi that we used to hold sway 1,500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, are not in monopoly control of that religion anymore. And on the ground, what you see more often than not is an Ashkenazi-controlled group, although some of the most powerful figures within Judaism are Sephardic, and that includes many of the Spanish families that have some of the largest fortunes.
Yes, the Sassoons, and the Sassoons intermarried with the Rothschilds.
That's right.
Who are Ashkenazi.
That's right. That's right. Well, and you also note that people, you find very new wealth come like Seligman and Brothman. These are Ashkenazi families that are also multi billionaires that hold sway in whole continents such as North America and so forth. But one of the things that you brought up in our private conversations was the diaspora of the Ashkenazi and what happened to this group when they were dispersed by the Rus or the Russians. And this was their dispersal throughout the European, Western European areas happened after the Russians finally, and this is before Russia was really a cohesive state. This is the formation of their state. They had it with the criminals to the south who were marauding a lot of their wealth and invading their southern borders and so forth. So they finally took it to them and kicked them out. Now, where do these people end up going, and what was some of the interesting points that you've discovered in history that have resulted in their ejection from that area of the Caucasus Mountains, southern Ukraine area?
Well, one of the most interesting points to emerge from Arthur Koestler's famous book, The 13th Tribe, is that Armenoid people seem to have an innate disposition toward criminality. And this has made them enemies of the entire world, which accounts, for the scattering of the diaspora, how they are dispersed throughout the Ukraine, Lithuania, the Baltic states, Russia, Transylvania, Bohemia, Moravia, Germany. In fact, the word Ashkenazi means German.
Well,
just as Sephardim means Spanish, because Sephard is Hebrew for Spain. Now, another point that Koestler makes, and sometimes Jews can be amazingly candid, is that the Ashkenazim outnumber their Sephardim counterparts by 24 to 1.
Yes.
In other words, what we see as Jews today are no connection with the ancient Hebrew monarchy that for a short time ruled certain areas in Palestine.
That's right. Well, they used that whole story, that whole demand to take the Middle East back. They needed a biblical reference in order to make it seem like they had a complete right to that area. And so, of course, they used the Sephardic story of having been ejected and not the Ashkenazi, which was in fact a conversion back in 740. And now you brought up an important point that I haven't been able to find exact information on, and that was what percentage of the Khazarian kingdom actually converted, and how much, you know, because the Khazarians were not a homogenous group. Many of the southern Khazars had more of the Mongolian hordes that had moved through their area. But if you got to the north of that region, there was a lot of Nordic blood that had moved into their family trees. So they weren't just a homogenous group either, although they were homogenous in their desire to make money off of other people. They were always brokers of things. They didn't produce anything of note in history, but they were always the middlemen. They stopped. You can find interesting stories about their demanding a payment for passage through their area and tribute, and they would take middleman cuts out of everything, which is not dissimilar to what they do today, is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right about the heterogeneity of their origins, but this applies to a lot of people,
yes.
To Tartars and to others. I think there are very few homogenous races in the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the nose, which we regard today as the salient characteristic of the Jewish physiognomy, came about through intermarriage with the Hittites. But going back to this, you know, who were the real inhabitants of Palestine? I find in Gavadi's book, The Case of Israel, which has brought him into such trouble in his native country of France, the following passage. Those who are nowadays called Palestinians, and Palestinian, you know, the word for Palestine in Arabic is Palestine, which is in fact the ancient Philistia. So, I mean, if anyone were the original inhabitants, the country after whom it takes its name, it was the Philistines.
That's right.
Who were defeated and massacred by the Jews. And he says, those who are nowadays called Palestinians are not descended from the Arabs alone. The Arabs arrived in the 7th century AD in small numbers. Converted to Islam, the major part of the population, including the Israelites, merged with them by intermarriage and introduced their own language. Well, that's certain. That's what they did in Spain. It's what the Arabs have done everywhere. The appearance of the Arabs in Palestine in the 7th century was far more of a cultural phenomenon than an ethnic one. The Palestinians are descended from the indigenous Canaanites who lived in Palestine 5,000 years ago, or at least since the beginning of the historical epoch, from the Philistines, also descended from the Philistines, who gave the country its name, and also from the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Arabs, and the Turks, who successively occupied the country, following the Babylonians, the Hittites, and the Egyptians. The first occupiers are these Palestinians, who have inhabited the country since the dawn of history. In other words, the people who have the moral title to the soil are the very people whom the Jews drove out.
Yes.
And paradoxically, these people were the original Jews who were defeated by Titus in AD 70, because sufficient remained after what Zionist propaganda refers to as the diaspora, sufficient remained to stage the Bar Kokhba revolt in 132 to 135 AD, and even after that was suppressed, there were around 70 communities in Palestine, established partly on the coast and partly inland, so that when in the year, the fourth year after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, in the reign of the Caliph Omar, Palestine, well, the whole of Syria, was conquered by the defeat of the Byzantine army at the Battle of the Yarmouk. Then these people, who included the Jews that had survived, became absorbed into the conquering Arabs, or rather, more accurately, the Arabs became absorbed into them. And thus the people whom the Jews drove out in 1948, you know, with the massacre of Deir Yassin and,
yes,
and,
yes.
The forced expulsions, were the real Jews.
Yeah, well, you know, isn't it interesting that even the term Philistine is in English parlance means barbarian. You know, if you saw, or somebody of very low character, if you say to somebody, James, you're a Philistine, that means that they're just ham-handed and they're uncultured and unrefined. And the fact of the matter is, if you take a look at the history of that people, what they have been is at a crossroads, a historic crossroads in the world, where their society has been subjugated and destroyed repeatedly and absorbed, as you've noted. The fact of the matter is that the Jews themselves, of at least the Sephardic Jews with Arab or Palestinian origins in their blood, these Semitic peoples are really the original inhabitants of that region, and the Ashkenazi who say that this is their right to go back to that homeland, it never was their home, James.
Claptrap. These people who drove the Arabs out of Palestine, they are, not to put too fine an edge in it, just ghetto scum. People like Yabotsinsky, a murderer, the Sterling Gang, Begin, and all these different terrorist groups.
Yes. And they weren't,
have no historical or ethnic claim to Palestine whatever.
That's right.
And the Sephardim, who are 1/25 of the Jews today, they have, in fact, lived amicably beside the Arabs for centuries.
Well, but not always without charge, though. I mean, there are Arab communities throughout North Africa where Jews have inhabited their own ghetto area, if you'll allow, where they've been charged with usury. And in fact, my father-in-law, having lived in Algeria in his youth, said that the Jews were the ones who ran most of the money trading and most of the bartering that went on in the marketplace, ultimately and led to the hands of a Jew. He told me that once a business deal was made between two Arabs, one of the parties with the money would end up having to find his way to some Jewish counting house or some Jewish intermediary at some point. And even then, in Algeria, they were holding sway over large amounts of trade and commerce through their penchant for dealing as middlemen. And that's exactly what he said.
Yes, and in Tunisia too, and Morocco.
Yes.
Throughout the whole of the Maghreb. Yes.
Well, but they've always been in that position. Even when you would look at Europe, they've stayed in a small enclave. They've branched out into the society itself, and they've amassed themselves fortunes through the use of money. And it's always been that way. Now it's because they understand how money works within a society, and they've always placed themselves in the most opportune position to profit from it, that they end up gaining and amassing a lot of power. And in many of the societies where they've kept a low profile, they've got away with it for centuries, if not millennia. But some countries, they have become so enriched and so wealthy that they begin to show off their wealth through the benefit of all of the usury. And the common folk living there who are being fleeced end up looking at them and saying, wait a minute now, you haven't picked up a shovel I've ever seen, and you're the richest person walking around here. How did this happen?
Well, this is greed. I mean, it was Goethe who said, genius consists in knowing where to stop. And I think this knowing where to stop has always been a European characteristic. But the Jews have never known where to draw the line, and they just go to excess. And thus they attract to themselves the hatred of all the peoples amongst whom they have settled.
And it's happening again, is it not?
I think it's rising. I mean, I keep a watch on the Jewish sites and the internet, and obviously they're very worried at the rise of what they refer to as anti-Semitism in Europe, in America, and in the Muslim world. I mean, this has even spread to Japan, a country where anti-Semitism was unknown.
Well, but do you know what the interesting thing is? On those Jewish sites, they never do an honest investigation as to why the anger is rising. They always make some off-cuff remark about, you know, it's age-old hatred of the Jew, when in fact it's actual circumstance that we despise them for, not necessarily the fact that they're Jewish or not Jewish, but the fact that they have positioned themselves to take advantage and to injure and the societies they live in. And this is what we see. Now, it's interesting also that many people in that community who are righteous people, they still benefit from the usury and from the activities of their criminal brethren. They take advantage by virtue of being Jews of the benefits that are flowing in that community. And I'll give you a good example. In the United States, if you are in television production or any kind of media production, and you graduate from college, if you come in and your name is Bernstein or Birnbaum or something like this, and you go for a job, you are immediately vaulted or at least taken in, and within a short period of time, you are in a powerful position, whether it be a newspaper or in a television production or a movie company, and you are given almost a free pass to the top. And that is not true of other groups. You don't see names like Murphy or Smith in some of these things. You don't see it. And while the Smith families may outnumber these Birnbaums 1,000 to 1, it's always Birnbaum that's running everything inside of the media. Or if it's same thing in the banking industry, same thing in the... you can go industry to industry and find the same story. So the community of Jews, whether or not they know there's a conspiracy, are benefiting regardless. Is that fair to say?
I think so. I would make two provisos. I'm not against Jews for what they are. Nobody can help what they are born. I mean, I could have been born a Jew instead of Scottish middle class, which is perhaps not much an improvement because the Scots are also obsessed with the accumulation of wealth. I am opposed to Jews, not on account of what they are, but what they do.
What they do.
And secondly, I am not opposed to all Jews, because I've known many excellent Jews, individual
yes.
who are Jews.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm opposed to is the policy of some Jews.
That's right. But see, but my point was this, and this is an interesting point, because I often make the same caveat statements you just made. I'm not against all Jews. However, the entire community of Jews, regardless of where they sit in the conspiracy, whether they're participants or not, are benefiting in some way.
Yeah, they are the beneficiaries, yes.
And so when you take a look at your, let's say your nest egg that you built over your lifetime is all of a sudden lost because of banking shenanigans, or it's lost because of criminal activity within the industry you worked in.
Yeah, and, like Maxwell, stealing the pension funds of his own employees.
Well, that's right. And you see that this is the way that your future is being set by, and you take a look at who's benefiting from it and who's not, and all of a sudden it comes back to a community of people. Hmm. And you say to yourself, wait a minute now, this is not more than a coincidence, because it's happened thousands of times in the past. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the ejections that this community has faced? Let's talk a little bit about some of the European ejections that have happened.
I think the first was England, 1290. The decree of Edward the First, England's greatest king.
Well, that's you know as well as I do that Longshanks had his own problems, and if you check my family roots through the family of Lydia Gray, who goes back to Longshanks, that's a very distant relative of mine, and the guy was a pretty brutal fella.
Oh my God! I mean, you're speaking to a Scotsman, don't
yeah,
I know?
Yeah, he was pretty brutal. So I mean, he's got his own stuff to answer to on judgment. Judgment Day. But my point is this: he made some very stark discoveries that communities of men that had very powerful financial ties were working against him, and he had to get them out of his kingdom, or he was never going to succeed in consolidating what he thought was he was entitled to.
Yes, the foci of their power at that time were Lincoln and York.
Yeah.
And there was a big massacre in York, you know, when they shut them in a tower and set fire to it. Hmm? So they've always been hated by the common people. But, you know, kings have been dependent on them because wars are costly business. And the only way you can mount a war against a neighboring state is by borrowing money. And in 9 cases out of 10, since the Jews were money lenders, they owed money to the Jews. So they were more or less always beholden to them.
Yes. But let's take a look at that then. And there were other reasons why they were rejected. I have to say that Saint Hugh, or there were several canonized saint children that were discovered bled out at certain points in history. One from the Italian region. It wasn't Italy at the time, but north of Rome in the northern Garda and area of this Como Lake. There was a young boy that was discovered to have been pricked and bled out in a ritualistic style or way, and it led back to a group of rabbis and Jews. But that same thing happened in England, and they had a real awful series.
Referring to St. Hugh of Lincoln, I think.
Yes, St. Hugh of Lincoln.
Yes, he was canonized. If you read the guidebook to Lincoln Cathedral brought out by the Anglican Church today, it skates over the whole thing. It virtually makes no mention of it. Of course, this is why Lincoln Cathedral became so rich. It was because of all the pilgrims going to visit this martyr's grave.
Well, but my point is this, is that there were a series of these events in England that prompted the ejection as well, not just the financial side of things, but there were some other heinous crimes.
Not just England, but Spain, even latterly Syria. The Padre Tomaso case took place in Damascus in 1850. Because Sir Richard Burton was British consul there at the time, and he recorded the whole thing.
Yeah.
He published a book, The Jew, the Gypsy, and El Islam. And then he did another one, Padre Tomaso, A Murder Amongst the Eastern Jews. And the book, I think his wife, who burned a lot of his manuscripts, for some reason it was overlooked in her hecatomb of her husband's writings, which included his diaries and his journals. Burton's sister insisted on its publication, and it was announced, and then to prevent it being published, the Jews bought the manuscript from the bookseller who owned it, and it was kept in a safe in the Jewish headquarters in London until a few years ago when, for some reason or other, they must decide it was safe to reveal its existence. In fact, when it was put on sale at a book auction in Sotheby's, strangely enough, no one bought it, so it's still there. Now, I mean, there are cases much later than that. There's one in Russia at the beginning of the 19th century.
Well, so, but my point is that people have made...
Sorry, at the beginning of the 19th century. No, sorry, I meant the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes, that's right.
Because I heard about it from a Tsarist exile living in Madrid, Professor Jarovsky.
Well, now, what we've got, though, my point is this, is that it's not always financial crimes that they're charged with or amassing fortunes on the back of their populace, but rather some of the bizarre ritualistic methods they use in the cohesion of their community. And so what we find here is especially this blood libel. Of course, anybody who brings up the word blood libel is savaged in the Jewish community, and I've brought it up at least a dozen times. And of course I'm persona non grata in anything to do with any Jewish site. You know, immediately I'm anti-Semitic and this and that. Fact of the matter is there's enough evidence of this not being fraudulent to say that at least several of the cases can be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I mean, there are so many strange things in Jewish history, like weird Kabbalistic sects. I wouldn't put it beyond them to require the blood of a Christian child for baking into the biscuits that are to be used during the Passover service.
A matzah.
Mm.
Now, you also note that this community here. Now, what we've got in the United States is back in the 1740s and 50s, there was a rise in a type of Jewish movements, like the Frankists put it out. Now, Frank started this Bohemian movement. Now, and in our parlance, we now know that if you call someone a Bohemian, they're somebody with very loose morals, with very fast-moving interests in sex and in gluttony and the rest. No modesty whatsoever. And that's what the word Bohemian means if you talk to somebody about it. But actually, the Bohemians was a Jewish sect that grew out of the Sabbatean movement, where they would have orgies and all kinds of sexual...
Sabbatean? You mean the followers of Sabbatai Zvi?
Yes, that's right. But now that morphed into the Jacob Frank movement, and the Frankists became this Bohemian group. And you'll find them throughout the United States today, many of them in very powerful positions.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Because the Sabbatai Zvi, at one time, I mean, people think of Jesus as the Messiah, but only Christians call him that. He had no more than 12 or 13 followers in his lifetime, 13 if we include Judas, whereas one-third of Israel believed in the Sabbatai Zvi's claim to be the Messiah. So he had a huge following. But ultimately converted to Islam. But these people, you know, the people who are following him converted to Islam, their conversion was never sincere. They are known as the Dolmas. And in Turkey, they control many things, finance, for instance, and banking.
Yes, the Dunmar, that's right.
And they're very prominent to journalism. So people get the wrong impression reading the Turkish press, you know, because those secular newspapers at the Cumhuriyet are all written for them by this very active minority who marry amongst themselves.
Well, we call them crypto Jews when we discuss them on the French Connection, and we have a large group of them in the United States. However, my point about the Bohemian mindset that came out of Jacob Frank's movement in Germany and in the I guess it was 1750s and 60s. We had families such as George Bush, believe it or not, and Solomon Bush were Bohemians that came to the United States and used their finance and monies to get into. They formulated lodges of Freemasonry in the United States, lent out money, became money changers, but they also adhered to very strange practices, and many of them ended up financing Hollywood, early Hollywood movies. And you'll find the mayor, excuse me, what's his name, MGM, mayor and the Warner...
Oh, Meyer, yes, and Goldstein.
And that's right. Now, these families were also very connected to this Frankist movement, and they are now showing their true colors by... You can see that the level of perversity...
Oh, you mean the promotion of homosexuality, the drug traffic?
Yes. Uh-huh. And you'll note that this is all rising now as this entire conspiracy attempts to go global. But you're seeing most of the filth being ejected from the United States. All of this film sickness and these media sicknesses that are coming.
It's what Francis Yockey calls the ethical syphilis of Hollywood, which has infected the whole world. Because who doesn't see Hollywood films?
Well, that's right. Now my point is this: is the last diaspora that they had? When was the last time they were ejected from a nation?
The first major pogrom in modern times was 1881 in Russia or the Ukraine, and beginning the following year, 1882, they start to flood into Britain, America, and that was really the time of the inundation, because until then we just had the Sephardim, who were a very small minority.
Yes. Now, of course,
and they brought with them a lot of loose morals. You know, it's these people who couldn't control prostitution, who run the white slave trade,
yes.
who are prominent in the drug traffic, who have made fortunes from pornography.
That's right.
Now, film is visual pornography.
Yes. Well, and now they've got so much control, they've made pornography mainstream.
Yes.
Now, you also note, James, that the ejection of the Jews from Germany and Poland was in fact engineered largely by Jews themselves. You can see at the top of Hitler's hierarchy, they were doing deals with Zionists from the beginning, and they were moving many of the Jews out of the northern European countries on boatloads to Palestine. And so that diaspora was actually engineered in large part by Jews themselves.
Yes, well, there was a diaspora of the German Jews in 1933, just after Hitler came to power, and a second one in 1938, following the Kristallnacht.
Yeah.
It's true, the Nazi regime encouraged them to emigrate to Palestine because they wanted them out of Germany.
Well, they were actually getting paid per family that would go to Palestine, and the Zionists in control of paying them said that if they don't go to Palestine, you don't get paid. And isn't it at the time when somebody said a cow in Palestine is worth all the Jews in Germany or something? There was a famous quote coming from one of the founders of this whole World War II exodus. But when you take a look at all of this history, and it's hard to find out where the lie starts and where the honest story comes, because if we read our history books, it's always written by the winners and by the influential people at the end of these events, and many of these events ended with the Jews in control. So you're not always getting the right history here. A lot of it has to be sent through a filter and divined through research. What other things have you discovered about these people's peregrinations over the centuries?